I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Two Norwegs podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined as always by my good friend, Timmy.
Hi, everyone.
B is the producer, as always. How are you, B?
Good, old, look, lads.
And our administration support, Katie Carroll, is here. How are you, Katie?
Nice.
Great. It's your first time in the studio.
Yeah, first.
Well, it's good to have you here, even if you are from Mahon. Frank Hogan, you're our guest today. You have a similar story to ourselves, and you're a trained counsellor, and you're a community worker. But we go way back, for the people that don't know you. Do you want to introduce yourself, tell us about where you're from, what it was like growing up for you?
Yeah. My name is Frank Horgan. First of all, I'm originally from East Cork, Middleton. I was born down there, big family, 17, 18 of us or something like
Didn't
that.
Did they call you Hoggy?
Hoggy. No, my brothers were Hoggy. I did all call me Frankie, but I like Frank, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Horgan's a pure Cork name, isn't it?
Hoggy, they all were Hoggy, but one of my younger brothers is the Hoggy guy. Yeah. So I'm just Frankie.
Frankie,
I like Frank, you know?
Yeah.
So look, I grew up down there, and I suppose, look, at a young age, I suppose, in the house I grew up in, look, no disrespect to anybody in the house, but my father would have been an alcoholic, but he wouldn't have thought so, to be honest, John. So it was a difficult house, a difficult environment.
How many siblings had you got?
I have 10 brothers and six sisters, five sisters.
What's the oldest and the youngest?
At the moment, I suppose, the youngest, I'd say, is about 40 at the moment, but like, I have 3 or 4 brothers deceased at the moment.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I suppose one of those would be from alcohol poisoning.
Go ahead.
Do you know what I mean? So, like...
In Middleton, within an estate, or was it on the countryside? Oh,
behind the hurling pitch. So I was in just outside of the town, up behind the supermarkets, you know what I mean? 60 seconds, you're down the main street, like, you know.
Did you play any over the sport down in Middleton?
No, because when I was younger, I suppose, at a very young age, my first court appearance, I was 9.
Go away.
Yeah, so I was...
In the court in Middleton?
In Middleton, yeah.
That courthouse there on the left hand side.
Exactly, yeah. So look, at the age of 9 was my first conviction.
Yeah.
And by the time I was 12, my brother, I was about 11. I had a brother, I was 11, brother 12, another 13. So my brother that was 12, he was after being in court 3 times that time. So he got 4 years in Letterkenny or Letterfrack, I can't remember which one. But I was convicted at the age of 9, my first conviction. And then I got a 12-month probation and I broke that again. I was up at the age of 10 and then I was back in court at 11. And my brother then got 4 years. So, and I had one day to go before the probation period was up. So I would have had Tim Farrell in my life at that time, probation officer.
Yeah.
And I suppose, look, at the time, I was only 12. I was into my antics then, but I didn't know why, you know. I was going to school, but I couldn't concentrate because it wasn't pleasant house, you know, there was a lot of violence and a lot of disturbances.
You're going into school, you're full of stress.
Yeah, and I mean, no wonder I couldn't concentrate, like, so I think I started drinking, I think it was 13 and a half when I first took my drink, you know, my first drink. And I was going into first year in technical school, and all I was remember walking back at lunchtime, and there'd be a car pull up and they'd be dragged into the police station and clattered in the back of the head and everything was done. I'd be brought in for it, you know. So I was always kind of known as troublemaker, like, you know, I would walk down the street, if somebody looked at me crooked, I'd slap them, like, and box them around the place, that kind of stuff, you know, stupid stuff.
Do you know why you were like that? Because you were used to violence in the family home.
I didn't understand it at the time.
Because we dealt... People that grew up in environments where there's violence, and I grew up in a violent environment as well, they think it's okay to do that. I thought it was okay.
Yeah.
You obviously thought it was okay.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the explanation for it. No, it's not justifiable.
No.
But that is why we do things like that. We deal with conflict through violence. And that's how we learned. You know, today my kids don't deal with conflict with violence. They try to sit down and they talk about it. Right? Yeah. They might draw a few words that you don't like. But that's it, really, isn't it, Frank?
Yeah. And I thought, I suppose at that time, I thought this was the norm in everybody's house. Like,
me too.
And we didn't talk about it. Like, and I suppose by the age of 13 and 14, like, if I heard the front door opening in the house, like, I'd open the window onto the ledge and sleep out in the field because it'd be more peaceful. And he said my father was very sick at the time, very ill. Mm. But he didn't see nothing wrong with it. And I suppose he was very unpredictable because, like, my father could come in now at 3 o'clock and he'd be hammered, like, and then some nights when he'd come in the evening, like, if he knew you were smoking, you know, he'd come in and he'd offer a cigarette, like, and it was all okay, you know. Mm. And then the next night when he'd come in, he'd give us a cigarette and the ones who take it then would get mangled, like, you know. So it was a tough environment. And I said by the age of 13 and a half, I decided I left school because I suppose I'd been arrested and been dragged into the police station and stuff like that. You know, it was just, I couldn't understand why I couldn't fuck in school because...
There must have been a lot of poverty in your home as well, Frank, I'd say, was there?
Things were tough because, you know, like my father would have been on illness benefit and stuff like that. I had an older brother at the time, he was 17, I think I was 12 at the time because I always remember. I was only 12 when he was involved in an accident up in Longtown area at that time and he died 6 months later. The drinking in the home then, my father, when he used to come out, like, just the behaviour and stuff. But look, I didn't know at the time, but looking back today, like, I suppose I've learned the skills to be able to survive through all of that.
How did something like that affect you and your siblings, like your older brother dying like that?
Yeah, I suppose thinking of my older sister, she would have been, she would have been married and out of the house.
Yeah.
My other sister was working. My brother was working and he had a good head in him at the time because he used to buy a few fags, box of fags, and he'd spread them out and he'd go out and have a few drinks. So there was no addiction issues. But the chaos inside in the family home then, with the father drinking every night and up and down to the hospital and stuff like that. And it was, you know, repetitive listening to it. And I suppose when I started drinking at 13 and a half, I started going to Red Barn and Yarl, you know. It was just... I was able to get into nightclubs. At the time, you had the ballroom dancing stuff. So I was able to get, when you work with carnivals that time, you get the passes. So, like, I was able to get in with them. But when I started going to Red Baron and Yard at 13 and a half, even 14, I was drinking. And I remember one day my father comes in and he says to me, sit down. And I said, yeah. He said, I heard you could drink me under the table, like, you know. Because somebody had told him, I went down, I ordered, I think, 14 double rums and 6 bottles of heart, and I just threw them down, you know. And like, when I used to drink, like, I didn't know, I used to drink to get drunk, like, you know, and I think to get away from it, but I wasn't too sure, you know, and every time I got to Red Barn then, like, I'd been in Red Barn for a couple of weeks, you know, and I used to love going down Sunday night after a long weekend, like, we'd sleep on the beach and stay there Monday as well, but...
And there would be a group of friends and...
Yeah, all in the bus, butlers, but used to drive the buses down, just get on, and I started working in a chip shop at 14 and a half, so I had my own money coming in. But I'd never had enough. Like, my mother would always tap for me Sunday night from a neighbour or something like that for me to go out for Sunday night.
Would this be the 80s, Frank?
Trying to think. I was 14.
Oh, yeah, we were.
74, 75. I was born in 1960.
They were definitely the
80s. Yeah. So early 70s, mid-70s, because that time, I remember the Monday mornings for me, I used to go into a pub called the Mill Wheel. And when you go in there, the place used to be joined there. And the only reason I used to go in there was to play poker to make more money. And the other place was another pub downtown. There was a Sunday night poker school there before you go to Red Barn. So I was able to kind of slip an odd card from the bottom of the deck and pull the last 3 that I had down. Do you know what I mean? And kind of trying to make money. So I knew how to do things. And it was all about making money to get out. But I suppose at age 14 and a half like that, like... I used to go to Red Barn and stay out. And then I used to come to the city when I was 16 because I used to go to the Stardust. People used to tell me I was mad because the boot boys would kick the head off you, all this stuff, you know. Mm. And then I started coming up to the Stardust, like, and I could be walking down Park.
Where was that?
It was down in the Grand Prix at that time, you know. The Stardust was there. Same fellow owned Red Barn. Owned it. Lucy. Owned it, like. And Dan Murray used to be on the door at him, big Dan Murray, like. And with Red Barn, then when I used to be down there, like I'd be in Red Barn and we'd get involved in an altercation in the hall, like, and we had a lot of stuff going on between the people in Yall, right? And I'd get phone calls in Milton, like, you're going to get it tonight. So I'd make sure I get down there and I'd wait till they come in and put them into the toilet, you know? Come on, let's do it. But every couple of weeks I would be barred from the club in Yall, like Red Barn from the hall, like, because of the what was happening. Yeah. And it was that violence coming out when I had drank. Like,
did you get through secondary school or did you finish up?
No.
I got 13 and a half.
I went into first year. But the exams came then, like, and I just didn't have any confidence and I didn't know what was wrong. I just pulled out, got a job and stayed out of school. So I finished school at 13 and a half.
And just drinking then, went to Red Barn, coming up to the city.
Yeah.
And getting then into mischief.
Mischief. And I suppose when I was hanging around that time, there was a pub down in Milton, down at Milton Arms Hotel, and I was hanging out. There was a couple of lads down there when I was kind of 16, 17-ish. They were older than me a couple of years, so I was hanging around with them because I knew they were into a bit of blow, like, you know. And I spent 6 months knocking at the door with them, like, and eventually, I remember the first night they gave in, like, and they gave it to me, you know. And I remember taking it, and when I went away, I said, what do I do with this? Like, so I made a one skinner, and I had it. And when I smoked it, like, it just made me, you know, I had no more problems, like, that's how I felt after having my first little blow, like, you know. So I started hanging out with them, and then there was a band, they had a couple of from Cline area, they had a band, and I started hanging out. So then I got a job over in the Keys in the city. I was a tyre fitter. So I was down in Riverstone first, and I transferred over. And I was tyre fitting, but then I used to go to the Old Oak Bar. So you could smoke away there, because the guy who had it then at the time, you know, was the next guard. And the sun would be at the door, closing the door, and you could come in with your bit of hash and be dealing away, like, you know, yeah, doing that kind of stuff. So I used to throw a bit off to make a bit of money, and I was still working. So I was working there for a while, and I think what happened to me that time, I went to a party out in the Blackrock Road one night, and I rang my mother to say, look, I won't be home tonight, right? And then, sure, I didn't know it, like, it was 3 or 4 or 5, 6 months later, I'm not really sure. My mother came up with my sister to the bus station to meet me, because I was looking for 500 quid. I was in debt, it was £500 that time. I was in debt because I owed it for drugs, like. And I was standing at the bus stop waiting for them to get out, and they got out of the bus and they were looking around for me, and I was standing there like, they didn't even know me because my hair was long. I wasn't out of even dirty clothes. And we ran out of money because I remember coming down to Black Rock, we were getting magic mushrooms at the time, right? And we ran out of magic mushrooms.
Picking them, like?
Yeah, picking them. And like, ringing up over in Rochestown, walking down the line, sure, I don't know what was going on. When the mushrooms were gone, then we used to do Pandrick sleeping tablets.
What are they called?
Pandrick sleeping tablets. You get them in a capsule or a blue at the time, right? But when you take them, like, you think you sleep, but you don't. You're up 3 days, you know? And you wake up hungry, but you're not asleep, you know, that kind of way. And then you go for something to eat and you can't eat. So we had no money. I had no money that time to do that. So I got involved in with another crowd from the north side up around the St. Luke's area. And I was getting my drugs on tick. And I hadn't the money to pay them, like, you know, and they were looking for me, like, and I think there was four or five brothers living in the same house as I was, staying, just partying. And then one night I was gone out and the door kicked in and they told me somebody was here with a weapon looking for you, like, and so, like, they were all freaked out, you know. But it was mad, like, you know, being up around that time, and, you know, like, I ended up in St. Anne's for a while. I don't know how long
it was. Psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
Go away.
Because I always remember being down in Middleton after coming back. Because when I arrived home, my father, you know, the long hair and the beard and the dirt and the shit. My father said to me, like, if you want to stay in this house, tidy yourself up. So the following morning, I got my mother to cut my beard, and I went down and got a haircut, and I put on a three-piece suit. And my sister comes in and she was saying to me, like, what are you doing with yourself? I said, I'm working in the bank in Cork, you know. But sure, I was off my nuts because I used to wear a robe with the bangs of sandals. You know what I mean?
The Gaelic Higgins.
And my sister was telling me one time she was talking to her neighbour down outside the house, like, you know. And
did you really think you were working in the bank?
No, I've been saying that all right. Because prior to that, I was wearing a monk's robe for a while with the sandals.
Yeah.
And she was telling me, she was talking to my neighbour, and the neighbour says, that's your brother. I don't know him at all, like. I still wasn't right, but I was unwell from taking the acid for about 6 months, like, you know.
Jesus Christ.
And I used to go down to my GP then, And when I was inside in the waiting room, I didn't know what it was, but I was paranoid. Like,
psychosis.
And I was screaming and roaring. So he'd take me out into another room because I said I'd wait, there's no problem. But I went and met him for a couple of, maybe 2 years.
Yeah.
And I came around again after about 2 years. I was normal. Because I remember one night, I was going down to the pub to meet the lads, you know, and I was tripping like, and I fell into a hole and I was only looking at the sky. Sure, I was there for about 2 hours in the hall, like looking at the sky off my face with the LSD. Like, but
how long were you in St. Anne's for?
I don't know.
Was it a few days or a few weeks?
I haven't a clue. I tell you, all I remember was when I was inside in the room and they came in with the white coats, I was like this, you know. I didn't know what was going on. Yeah. You know what I mean? Going to my GP then, checking in with him and doing that kind of stuff.
That sounds like a really mad period of
nightmare.
How long did this go on for?
I was seeing Lincoln with the doctor about. Between anywhere between 12 and 12 months and 2 years.
But just all this
just
going
come back. And I think of my realization afterwards was I was tripping all the time.
Uh-huh.
And I found it hard to come back.
Yeah.
To normality.
Look, you came back, Frank.
I know.
Because
I know.
There's a lot of fellas out there like from taking acid like that and they're still fucked.
The mad, yeah. I was lucky.
Do you know?
And I suppose when I put down the drugs that time, the drinking took over. And I was drinking like any time I could, you know, any night. The weekends were always like, if you get ready to go to Red Barn, like, you know, like Sunday night, like if I was working Saturday night or Sunday night, I'd make sure I'm finished. I'd get the bus anyway. I'd get some way down to Red Barn. And if there's a bank holiday, you can sleep on the beach and stay there. You wouldn't have to come home. My parents never worried about me that way because you could go. But I suppose when the drugs went out of my life, they all went. I started drinking heavier. I got married when I was 20. And my son was born in 1980. I got married in July. My son was born in December. And my wife at that time, we would have met when we were 15. I was up and down to a dance hall in Kill at the time and stuff. But I got married at 20, by the age of 21. I came home one day, like, and she was gone, like, you know, and I had no clue. Somebody said she's gone, and it was because of the violence and stuff and the shit I was bringing into the house, you know, and my behaviour. So what I did was,
She left with the kid and left.
She left, yeah. She left, yeah. She left. She was gone, and I didn't know what was going on. I was kind of like, I was so out of touch, and I suppose at that time. I used to have a bottle of vodka, a bottle of whiskey and a bottle of brandy in the house, but I would have preferred the powers, you know what I mean? I'd swap it if I could in the pub for the brandy and stuff. And I got a job above in the Creamery Mogheely at the time, you know? And I was doing shift work, like, and I drink before I go to work. If I was on 62, I'd be up at 3 o'clock drinking. And when I finished at 2 o'clock, I'd be in the pub all night and drinking, you know? And then I decided one night, I went into St. Stephen's Ward in Glenmire, Sarsfield Court. I went to my GP and I had enough of it. You know, I knew it was gone. Like, I knew the mind was gone as well. So I went to my GP and I got a letter on a Friday to go to Sarsfield Court.
What age were you, Frank? Sorry.
Was 23-ish.
A young man, like,
you know, I was thinking of a lot of serious consequences there very early.
23, I'd say.
Uh-huh.
22, 23. Uh-huh. But when I went
you started very young.
Yeah. And when I was in Sarsfield Court then, I got the letter from the GP. So what I did, when I went down to a pub called The Satellite on a Friday, and then I said I'd have a drink and I'd go. Monday morning, I was still sitting down drinking in the pub, like, you know. Uh-huh. And I just broke down crying, like, and I just couldn't understand. So I rang a taxi. And I always remember her name, Mrs. Maloney. She's a taxi service in Milton. And I rang her and asked her, would she collect me in the pub? And I said, I need to go to the hospital. So she collected me and brought me up. And the first night I went to Sarsfield Court, and I went in and gave them the letter. And, you know, you're signed in and stuff. And sure, I was put into my room. And next thing, sure, half an hour later, I was down the hallway begging them to let me down to the village for a drink. Like, I was in bits, you know. I was crying on my knees and my hands to get out of the place at that age. So when I was in there, I got friendly with these two guys. They were both Pats, right? And
they were both what?
Their names were Pat.
Okay.
Both of them. Like, and I became kind of got close with them, you know. Because when you're rattling a place like that, you don't want to mix with anybody. But I got these two guys. I got friendly with them and let them in a bit. So when I got out of when I got out of hospital after my 30-day dry out, you know, it was a dry out period, like, you know. Mm-hmm. I went back to work in the creamery at the time, like, and I remember going in, and then the manager calls me into the office and he wanted to talk to me, like, I went in and sat down, like, and he said, can I ask you a question? Like, and I said, yeah. He said, what is it about you, like, when you start drinking, you can't stop? And he said, something like that. And we left it at that then, you know. Yeah. And I was back in work anyway. And a few months later, I couldn't give you an exact time, but I met one of the Pats in the city one day and he was hammered, like. But I used to phone the other fella. So he was kind of gone out of my life, you know. Mm. I was going to meetings. I met a guy. There was a guy in recovery. He was 20 years around at the time, and I always remember it, like. And the priest, the local priest in Castlemartre, had rang this guy to come up and talk to me at the time. So I went out and I met him on the bridge there where Pat Short's pub was there, Barry's had it at the time. And I was out on the bridge waiting, he came along, like, and we were talking away. I was telling him what was going on, like, and he said, I can't fucking sleep. Like, you know, he says to me, and he turned around, he says to me, don't worry, no alcoholic, never lay down in the lack of sleep. I thought he was going to give me a tablet to help me sleep, like, but he blew me out of the water with this. So he brought me to a meeting in Middleton that night, and I remember being at the meeting with him. And we were sitting at the meeting, and I can always remember who was doing the chair as well. And next thing, your man started sharing his story, like, and I was there, like, and I was saying, I tipped your man next to me. I said, you tell him about me, like, you know, totally in my own head.
That happens,
like, you know?
A lot, don't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. So I was going to meetings for a while, and going on and off, maybe, you know. And I think I relapsed then again.
That was your first introduction.
That was my first. I was 21 when I got into the rooms at the time, yeah.
I think the point there for the people listening and watching to elaborate on, like, sometimes you could be in a meeting like that and the person sharing, you, there's so much identification with the story that it, when you're early days, you would think the one of the boys is after telling him to say this.
Yeah.
Do you know? But it's just like that. We're just so alike with similar experiences, different people and backgrounds, but brings you down the same path.
Mm. And I think at the meeting that time, I was waiting for everybody to start laughing and point the finger at me, you know.
Yeah.
I just thought it was all a big setup, like, and they were after telling me about me and stuff. But look, I struggled for the meetings. I was in and out and I relapsed. And one night, I was inside work. I was on an evening shift. I was on a 2 to 10. And it was on 16th of June, 1984. I'll always remember, right? So I went up to the office, to one of the office, and I made a phone call to Pat. And I had a Mallow number for him. And I went up to the office and I rang and sister answered the phone. And I said, I just, can you speak to Pat, please? She said, I can't really talk. The kids are here. And I said, that's grand. Look, I'll ring back. And she turned around and she said, look, Pat's dead. So that night, I made my decision. I didn't go to the pub after work. I went back to meetings. And I haven't drank alcohol since that night.
Since 1984.
So it's 40 years next
year. You're off to drink longer than I'm alive.
Yeah.
1983, Pat.
1984, the 16th of June.
You're was so Pat's month.
I know, yeah.
So
How did, to kind of bring it up a little bit, how did drugs and prison come into your life then, if did alcohol left?
I was doing well in recovery for a while, a couple of years. Things were going well. So I was stuck in Mogheely Development Association.
Stuck in Mogheely. Mogheely followers won't be too fond of.
But somebody came to the door when they asked me, would I sign up with the soccer club? So I became a player. And then I became PRO.
Can I guess your position? Can I guess your position?
Go on.
You look like a right full back to me.
Centre half. I was mad centre half.
A winger,
yeah.
Okay.
So look, I joined up with the club to make the numbers. We were a small village. And then I started getting involved with the Mogheely Association. We were raising money for a tennis club and stuff like that. And I was sober and I was doing well. And then one night the priest knocked at the door. Like, I remember a guy in recovery said to me, like, there'll be a day coming, there won't be enough hours in the day for you anymore. And I said to him, you're off your game. Like, and it was 2 years later when the priest came to the door knocking, he wanted me to do something else, no? And I was looking to the sky, I said, God, is there enough time in life anymore for me, like, you know? And I was doing okay. Do you know, I was stuck. And next thing, I got a job in Middleton anyway. I was running a snooker club. Everybody knows my background, right? I was running a snooker club for two lads that had it at the time. And I was still clean, sober, going home, you know, the second son, and going home at night time, the 11 o'clock bus, and I would have to go off from Castlemartre to Mogheely, like. And everything was going grand, you know. My life was good. I had no car. I used to cycle to Gary Rowe with my wife, and we'd have the kids and the old crossbars. And I think it took me about 20 years to identify this, but I got it eventually, but I'll come back to it in a minute. But one night I was inside Mark and just tidying up around, this fella came up to me, he says, would you like to smoke? Would you like to smoke a bit of ganj? I didn't know what he was on about. I said, what are you on about? He said, he had a bit of poking, a bit of ash or something. He says, yeah, yeah. So I had a smoke. Mm-hmm. That was my first time trying it again, right? What a journey, like, you know, mm-hmm. from then, because...
We're talking about
1981.
Recovery,
right? I was recovery that time. Yeah. And I was happy, like, I was content.
You're still going to meetings?
Still, no, yeah. I tap in now and again because I tried to go outside of the city because of my own personal room as well. Yeah. But I had the smoke anyway, and that just escalated. And by the end of from the kind of 90 into 91, that happened. And then 91, somebody said they were going to Henry's, like.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'll go for a look, like, throw back an E, like, you know.
That was the end of it.
That was the end of it.
That was the end of it.
That was the end of it. Yeah.
And we all know that one.
I started thinking then, I suppose, like, you know, it was hard to keep smoking, and smoking was increasing on a daily basis, smoking and work, smoking on the way. And, like, I remember going to the city, you could have a joint in the fucking bus. Nobody took any notice, like. But the whole lot started growing out, and I was there one day and I was saying, like, how can I make a free bit for myself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I remember buying a quarter ounce, you know, I get it for 30, and I was selling a 20 block, so I did 20 for myself for 10. So then that kind of escalated up to a half an ounce, to an ounce, a bear, a key.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got associated with people on the north side. You know what I mean? I won't mention them, but they're very...
They went up the Norries boy.
Norries boy, you know? But I got in with this crowd, and I was getting my hash, and I was passing it on to people. I was, you know, I was distributing it in a way, like, and then I had people coming to me and I'd give throat bars and keys, and I was trying to make a few pound and make free. But when I got into the E's, then, like, it was just I tried it, like, you know. So within 3 months, like, I was in Henry's Thursday night, Saturday night, and if there was long weekends, like. And then what happened was, by the end of that year, my shifts were 11 to 11. So I'd been working at 11 in the morning. By 10 past 11, I was anywhere in the country, like, it's doing what I need to be doing, like. And just buzzing all day, like, and having somebody cover my shift and making money, just phone calls coming in, having somebody else sort it out and stuff like that. Invincible in one way of feeling, like. But while I was working then, the guards would be sitting outside the door because I was under surveillance all the time, and they'd be blocked and stopped and searched and stuff like that. My house out in Mogheely was searched at the time, like, and my wife had a bad experience. And I remember going up to pick up my kids from school at the tech. They were only about 14 and 13, 12 at the time. And I remember pulling up, reading the echo, and they just swarmed in. And when my kids came out of school then, like, they saw me handcuffed, like, and they were bits. But look, that struggle went on for a while, them and me, you know?
Yeah.
And having to, I remember playing a game only with them. I just wanted to kind of wreck their heads, you know. So my buddy was on the scanner and he was talking to me and he was telling me that they're watching you. So I went up and we got a box of Daz and we wrapped it up, and he has a package. Has he worked the boys, you know? Has he worked it? They said, no, leave it to the elite. But he told me they lost me up around Silver Springs, you know. And I used to be kind of playing along with this. But look, I got into Henry scene at the time, and then I got into the scene by knees, and, you know.
How did it come to a head for you?
I suppose that went on for, I went into Arab House at the time when my marriage went that time.
It was like a day of treatment sort of.
When I got back with my marriage that time.
Yeah.
And the recovery, everything was going well. But when the drugs came back into my life, like I was never present, like, you know. I was out of a Thursday night. I mightn't get home again for God knows when. Or somebody might bring me home and throw me to bed Wednesday night and get up again and do it all again. Like, I went to Arab House, and my wife was on the other side of the programme. I was working the programme, and I was doing good. And 15 weeks intense phase in the Minnesota model.
Yeah.
And I got over the line, and then one night a friend of mine was dropping me to the city at the time, and he says to me, will you skin up a joint for me? It's in the glove compartment. So I skinned it up and I had a smoke with him. So when I went into group, I was going around trying to get a bogey urine, you know, a clean one from somebody, and have it in my pocket, and I was parrying it over my head. So the first night I was in aftercare, my head was mental, like, I was destroyed, and I'm trying to hold it together, like. So on the second night I went up, I just decided to put my hand up, you know. I said, I'm after relapsing. So they pulled me out of the group. And what that meant to me that night was unbelievable. I felt like a failure. So what I did was, I didn't go back to the treatment centre anymore. I felt complete and utter failure.
Mm.
I got involved in the drug scene. I was invited down to Killarney one night with all of the heads, like. There was, what would you call it? When somebody was getting married, one of the guys was getting married, and what did they call it for the guy?
Stag.
So we were down in the hotel in Killarney and we were sitting down. And never had coke. You know, I had tried coke, but sitting down, happy enough, having a few joints and taking a few sweets or whatever was going, like, you know. But this fella was sitting next to me and he slid over his hand. He said, do you want to try some of that? So I took the bag. I didn't know what he had. So I went up to the room and I'd say it was about 3/4 of an ounce of coke there, like. And I went up to the room and, you know, I'd done a few lines and snorted and it was absolutely beautiful. That's the only way I can describe it. So I came down. And he said, how was that? And he said, absolutely beautiful. So I went to give it to him. He said, no, that's yours. Like, and I was like, sorry, what? Do you know what I mean? For me, like. So I got to like it. So I found out then, like, I started getting an ounce off him to start selling it, to keep it going. And the first week I got an ounce, sure, it was gone. I had to go and get two. By the end of the month, I was getting a bar, a 9 bar. Then it was going up after that.
Can you talk to me about that? Going from the, like, in terms of society, going from the ecstasy scene to the coke scene, that transition, was it like everybody was on the ease and then overnight the coke kind of took over, or was it a gradual? Can you talk us about that?
I suppose when I was taking.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
E's that went on for 12 months, like,
yeah,
and I would do it every day, and I'd have to have 15 E's going to Henry's, like,
yeah.
And if they were, if Kelly's, pink Kelly's came in at time, they were rubbish, I'd make sure I'd have 1,000 away from myself at stock, you know.
Yeah.
I'd make sure the biscuits would be there for myself, you know.
Yeah.
I'd have supply for the year, like. But when I went into treatment that time and I got clean,
yeah,
there was, the substance were gone.
Yeah.
But when I picked up when I felt like that failure there anyway, when I took a bit of coke,
yeah,
that became the
drawing the cocaine came into your life. Was the ecstasy a big scene in Cork still?
But I was so detached. I think I was so detached because my focus was gone to this numerical thing I found. Like, this was the business, like.
And the late '90s, early noughties, the cocaine started really taking off in Cork.
Yeah.
I remember that time he started dying down in 2000, 2000, and then the cocaine.
Henry's closed and things like that.
We're still,
yeah.
But it's kind of miss a match. No, if you look at 2022, it's like cocaine is up here, you've 90% and then you have about 10% of it.
One or two buzzers then around the gas.
And I think that time then, because I never went back drinking.
Yeah.
And I remember being in clubs and lads that have a drink tonight, you know, it's Christmas week. And I'd say, if I have a drink, we'll never be friends again.
Yeah.
But what I used to do was buy sweets, boys, and I'd make sure I have 20 on me all the time. And then one time, I went to my GP and I was getting them, but then somebody talked to me about the Rohypnol, you know?
Yeah.
The purple hearts.
Lovely.
So I went to my doctor and he said, hey, look, somebody gave me a Rohitlin or something the other night. And he said, Rohypnol. And I said, I was able to sleep. So he gave me a box. And I had to go back to
it's a big upgrade from a D5, isn't it?
Unbelievable. But I used to take them in the morning, have one, and then do a half gram or a gram straight away. And it would keep the edge off.
Yeah.
Then I'd start getting two boxes, and then I'd have my name on the box to go up around the north side to buy them.
Yeah.
And that was what I fought to take the edge. The lads be lashing back to get and stuff like that, drinking away. But the coke took off then, because once I walked away from services, especially Arbor House at that time, I hadn't, you know.
No support, like
nobody. There was nobody in my life, like. It was horrible, like.
So how did you end up in the prison? No matter what year was this?
When the coke took over, I was on the streets doing my thing, and I had a few little boys following me around all the time, and it was just like being torn out of it all the time, being stopped and searched under, being misuse of drugs, act and stuff, but. I was always thought it was a bit cuter if I had a gram or two in my mouth, I'd swallow it, you know, with a bottle of water. And I met my new partner at the time in St. Henry's. I was clean at the time. And I was clean at the time when I met her. But then I went back using. We had two children as well. And that relationship, I moved to a place called Green Hills Court. And I remember driving down to Douglas Road one day. And my two kids were in the car. And I drove in. I was driving in there, and next thing, blue lights came after me. And I ran to the road. Ah, you snuck in under our nose. I said, I didn't sneak under nobody's nose. I live here, boy. So I was in Douglas, living in Green Hills Court, and I was still involved in a bit of business, I call it, doing a bit of drugs, you know. And then, on the May weekend in 1999, after being pulled in and out all the time and chased around, like, I went over to meet this guy to give him a bit of hash, like, and I left and I drove over to the swimming pool, Douglas, and I was driving in, and the guy was standing there, and I opened the window of the car. I had a 20 block or something in my hand from him, like something like that, you know. Next thing I looked in the mirror, I saw two cars coming. I said, I need to pull in. Next thing I saw, the blue lights coming out and going on, like, and I was arrested, and I was brought back to the house.
They had a warrant for the house.
So when I was standing at the house, they were all there and they brought me in and they were going through it, like. And I felt confident because they had nothing in the house, you know.
Mm.
So when I was standing outside the house, your man brought me out and he put his hand on my shoulder. I think he said, I'm resting under section 15 now. So I said, what's section 15? Because I didn't know what he was on about. So he said, come with me and I'll show you. So he brought me around the corner, goes into the field, lifts up the sod. And he lifts up the sod. That's what I'm talking about, he said. So I think there was about six and a half ounces of hash and maybe a couple of grams of speed or something like that. That was much anyway. Yeah. 6.5 ounces there. So I was arrested that night, taken to Torquay for a section. That night then I was held. And it's funny, even though they were still inside, you know, I was able to tell them I had medication at home and I asked them to go and get it and they got it. It was the purple hearts, like the...
How naive they were back then. You wouldn't get away with that now.
So they went over and got them. So what I did when I was taking out two to go to sleep, I took out four and I kept two for the morning because I knew I was going to be interrogation. And I suppose being interrogated that night then, like, and these two guys came in and one of them said to me, you're known to us as the quiet guy, like, you know. And then two more came in and one started running back and forth. And I couldn't figure out what he was saying. Then he picks up the hash and he said, it had to be hot, did he use gloves or not? So I denied it all, like, you know. And then they released me the following day. And I was in bits, like, you know. And I decided, like, the game was up, you know. And I went back to Arbor House. Maybe a week or two later, I drowned in my sorrows and as much as I could with what I could take. So I went back to Arbor House again and I contacted them and I'm saying, like, look, I have a trial coming up. I know I'm going to jail, like, I'm not going to bullshit you, but I know this is happening. I want to go into prison clean and I want to get my time done and come out clean. That's all I want to do. So the assessment, I felt, went on for a long time, you know. But I eventually got in there. I got clean. I done the intensive phase again. I went on to aftercare and I asked them if I could stay on because my trial was coming up. And I remember being charged, presented with the book of evidence and stuff like that, and going across to the courthouse, John Sheedy at the time, you know. And I remember when the trial came up, like, and I went to Camden Quay, and I was nervous, like, I was clean. I stayed on the aftercare. And I remember going to a counsellor in Arbor House at the time, like, and I wanted to talk to her, yeah, because the anxiety was building up.
Mm-hmm.
And I had nobody to trust, you know, and you don't trust nobody in the game that, like that you're in. I couldn't anyway. So I went up to this counsellor and I said to her, look, my trial is up to my sentence. I'm being sentenced tomorrow. And she says to me, you know, she says, trust in your higher powers will for you, you know. And I said, no. I said, you're not hearing me. I'm actually being sentenced. She says, I know. Trust in your higher powers will for you. But the court, when I went out to be sentenced, they decided that they needed a report from the counsellor in Arbor House. And when the counsellor came in, I'll always remember the judge turned around and he said to her, like, you know, about this, like, that. He asked her some questions and he said, is there evidence of Frank Horgan trying to get help before and now? She said, yeah, Frank Horgan came to Arbor House in 1991. He couldn't stop using. Came back again, he completed the program, he's in aftercare at the moment, so it's all in his file. So the judge put his head down and he, you know, he was saying something and I didn't know, like, because I was living over in a flat at the time in Victoria Road. And when I had decided to stop, I had drugs in my wardrobe and I went down to a buddy of mine living underneath and I knocked on his door and I just blew him a favour and I said, take these for me. And that Friday night, it was the 16th of June, because it was the May weekend, I got busted. Mm. I went to a meeting and the drugs stopped and I gave him all the drugs and I started going back and I got involved in meetings and I got into Arbor House, thank God, you know. And thank God, I haven't looked back since then, right? But I had to go into prison when I got sentenced that day. Sure, I hadn't a clue what the judge was saying. Like, and then I heard 7 years, like, because my buddy says to me, what do you think you're going to get? I said, at least seven. And when I got to seven, then I heard another seven mentioned, like. And I didn't know what he was talking about, like, because you don't understand what they're telling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he gave me two seven years consecutive possession with intent to supply.
Concurrent.
Concurrent, one after, run them in together.
Running together.
And my knees just went weak, like, you know. Because I've seen people inside with three, I remember one guy had three keys, like, and he got 2 years. And, you know, the whole motto, if you're a good talker, a good walker.
Yeah.
And like, I remember when I went to trial, even, when I went down to the courthouse in Camden Quay, Tony comes in, right? You know what I'm talking about? Tony comes in, like, and he comes up to me. He says, how are you pleading? I looked at him. I said, like, I was still arrogant, right? And I said, pleading for what? What are you talking about? So the next thing he lost is, you know, I've got to get the fucking main witness in here. I said, do what you want, you know? So there was two more up for a manslaughter charge that I knew from the north side. So I waited outside to see what was happening outside the courthouse. And the two of them comes out to me and they says, your trial date's fixed for, I said, for when? For the 8th or the 10th of May or something. I said, that's tomorrow morning. So the trial date was fixed for the following morning. So I was standing there, like, and I said, I have to come back tomorrow. The trial was going to go ahead the following day, like. And I made a decision then the following morning to come to trial. I called my solicitor and I said, will you talk to Tony and ask him? If I plead guilty, will they give me continuing bail? That's all I want. So that was agreed. So I went in and went in. I think the jury would be sworn in. So I went in, they were saying it was a plea. So that was, they were dismissed. So I pleaded guilty to charges. And
You got the 7 year for the hash. What was the second one?
One for possession, one for supplying.
Wasn't it?
That was a big one, like, yeah. Yeah, what they had, their argument was they were after me for 12 and a half years and it was a significant...
They usually take the lesser one kind of into consideration and just run with the...
You'd know convictions for drugs at this stage?
No, but look, I've had previous convictions for car theft, burglary. I have, I think, maybe 18 or 19 convictions for drunken driving, maybe two occasions stealing vehicles.
But they wanted you for a while and that was their opportunity.
Yeah, they were saying that this was going on for a long time and that their point was I was after looting a few surveillance operations because they were after targeting me in different houses because I was living, moving house all over the city. And they were after raiding different houses ahead, but they never got nothing. But they used that then, saying that I was after looting a lot of surveillance operations and that this was significant as far as they were concerned. They said I was a cunning and devious drug dealer. Mm.
But you turned it all around?
Yeah, I think when I got back to Arbor House that time, and I got through that intensive phase again and hung on to aftercare, went to meetings, and I was going to 9 meetings a week.
Yeah.
And when I was in treatment then, they were saying to me they wanted me to cut back meetings. I said no, because I didn't want to go back where I'm coming from at the time. So I kept going to meetings Wednesday and Saturday. It was 2 meetings a day, and it was at a meeting every night.
And was it difficult to maintain the meetings in prison?
That first night that they called for the prison when I was sentenced, I was standing over at the back of the wall in the old prison, and I couldn't, when they called for the NA meeting, I couldn't take the step forward because I was thinking, they all fucking look at me. And everybody knew who I was like.
Yeah.
And then the guy next to me turned around and he says to me, come on, we're going for the buzz. So I said, yeah. So yeah. I walked into the meeting and I was delighted because once I got in, I kept going then.
Yeah.
Friday night for the NA, and then I used to go to the A meetings. I got into the school then doing pottery and stuff like that. Selling my pottery at Christmas time, doing bean bags, and keeping myself busy. And I had the NA books inside because I couldn't get them in because of the hardcover. So somebody came up with the idea of taking the hardcovers off and they got them in.
And I remember, you used your time.
Yeah.
You used your time instead of your time using you. Yeah.
Kind of like you to me.
Yeah. Mm, yeah. And I think the time inside in prison then, like on the streets that time, I wasn't familiar with heroin.
Mm.
But while I was in prison, like it was just everywhere in your face, like. People were just, you know. So I had...
What year was that?
I was sentenced in 2000.
2000.
Mm. There was a lot of...
Cork, would be much gear on Cork testation?
Not in the city, but probably through the
prison. Yeah.
There was a lot of Dublin heads down as well. Yeah. And it was plentiful. Mm. But I had decided before going in, I was going to mix with nobody because I said, that guy coming up to me in the air shaking my hand, or, you know, people sending a package under my door. I knew if I didn't change that, when I go back in the next one, I'd be looking at 10 plus, you know. So I done the 12 months. I went down for, I'll always remember going down for my review, you know.
Mm.
And I had the help over. My brother called and they said it was the guards, and I thought it was another charge I had. When I went down to court that day, I think there was 31 of us up for review, and I was the last one. And when I went in, called in, the drug squad went up in the box like and said, Your Honour, we don't want him released. He's not out of circulation long enough. And the judge looked down, and he looked at all the stuff that I'd done. My urines were clean and they were pulling me at random. So, but I wasn't worried about that.
Yeah.
I just knew that I had to get through this phase at the time.
Yeah.
So when the judge turned around, he looked at everything. He said, you know, I'm very happy with you. You're free to go.
Whoa.
I was delighted.
So you got a review after 12 months?
After 12 months.
Fuck it, that was not bad.
Yeah, that was grand. And look, what I'd done and focused on in prison was myself. And I think I was able to go back. And he was able to see there was no, I just didn't want to be going. And I said that time when I got released, then tied in with Park Lines.
But there's something to take from this, right?
Mm.
Like you were absolutely adamant that you were going to get recovery into your life.
Mm.
Like you weren't fooling no one, right? For that 12 months and before that, while you were in treatment, you knew that you wanted to get sober and you wanted to be abstinent from drugs.
Mm.
You know, and some fellas would be smart enough to do it the other way and then get out and go back in, and you know, but like it's a great example to show like you can stay sober and abstinent from drugs in prison if you put your head down.
Yeah.
You know, you can't
get involved in the dramas and the politics.
Stay clear of everything else.
Well, the decision was not to mix with nobody, and there was hooch up in the A3 at the time.
Yeah.
And it was like because people knew I was in for drugs. You were okay. You get looked after, you know, that kind of way. Mm. But I knew that that's not what I wanted. Mm. I knew that when I go back out, I'd be exactly the same, you know.
Yeah. Mm.
And it was tough in prison.
Yeah.
Do you know the way I can describe it to the Sundays, right? The weekends were horrible. Saturday, you have the roast beef. Or Sunday, you have roast beef or roast pork. In the summer and the winter, it's either a salad and Mondays or a stew.
Mm.
Do you know? I used to walk out the yard and watch the phone calls, you know. Watch people slamming their hands on doors to get out to the hospital to pick up the package. Do you know all this stuff? And then the phone calls and the arguing at the visits, like, all for drugs, like.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Do you know why? People can't cope, like.
Mm.
like you've some of the most traumatized people in society inside in prisons.
Yeah.
Right. And I always say this, I'm not justifying anybody's actions here, but you have some of the most traumatized people inside in prisons. Mm. Most of them are addicted to drugs and alcohol. Okay.
Mm.
And what are you taking away from somebody when you lock them up?
Yeah.
The one thing that gets them through life, which is drugs and alcohol, and that soothes them. So, like, you can imagine why people will go to any lengths to be able to get what they need to be able to help them.
Remember back in the day, do you remember the old jugs? They were hard plastic.
The hard plastic ones,
they used to be breaking each other's hands with the jugs to get out to the hospital, to get drugs out of the toilet in the hospital, gas and that. Frank, we're going to speed it up a bit now because we're a bit tight for time. But like myself and Timmy, you linked in with Cock Alliance and Sheila. You went into education and started to rebuild your life. I'm interested in talking about what you're doing now.
I suppose, look, when I came out and I returned to education, Stefan Neffer, for 2 years, I'd done my degree in social care and I went down and done counselling through Arbor House.
Yeah.
And I'm accredited counsellor as well, but I never take credit for it. Brilliant. So look, I got a job when I came out of prison. I went to Simon as a volunteer. And I believe you were there, yourself.
I was, I
went as a volunteer.
In many capacities.
Yeah. And I went there and I just said it to him, look, I'm only out of prison. If it's a problem, I understand. So they took me in as a volunteer. I applied for relief. I got relief. I went into outreach. I was in the shelter working in the projects. So I spent 13 and a half years at Simon.
Yeah.
And then I started working with people that were using IV drug users and watching the transition from smoking to injecting. And then I became a needle exchange worker. And then I was doing a lot of training around that. And then 9 years ago, this job came up and I was fearful taking it because it was a 2 year contract and I was saying, like, who's going to hire me in 2 years' time? So I took the job anyway. And part of the job was two days a week in Mitchelstown. The YHS was a half day and 2.5 days on the streets.
On the streets doing what?
What I do is go out and I link in with, I visit areas where people were using drugs.
Squats and places like that.
Yeah, there'd be hotspots, we call them, right? So people would buy drugs and look, the nature of the game when people buy, they're sick, they need to use where they're at.
Yeah.
So a lot of people were discarding drug litter. So my job is to go out and kind of identify these areas, clean them up, but it also gave me a platform to engage with these people. So then after 2.5 years of doing this, my boss came to me one day, he said to me, we have good news for you. And I said, we're getting a safe injecting room. He said, no, we're taking you on full time. So the Mitchelstown piece went and I focused on the city. So the platform I have today, particularly Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays, I do street work. So I work Tuesdays in the YHS, but under 24s around substance misuse. I'm in the prison doing the Loxol training.
YHS is what?
The Youth Health Service.
Yeah.
And then I work in the prison on Tuesday and I do groups in Arbor House for the Loxol training.
And do you know naloxone?
Yeah.
There's two versions of it. There's an injection and the nasal. What's more common?
Well, I suppose at the time, when you look at it, when I started my job, the first week, my line manager says to me, look, I know you're starting next week, you're on holidays. When you come in, you're going to ward for training Monday and Tuesday. Then when you come out back, you're going to roll this out. At the time, there was only the injection one available. And the Loxol is used to reverse the effects of opiate drugs like heroin, morphine, OxyContin, Tramadol. So that was the only one available at the time. But now there's a bit of legislation change. So the nasal one is there now. But they're both doing the same.
Yeah,
you have some people who maybe be afraid. I train a lot of frontline staff in homeless services, but you might have somebody who has a fear of needles, so the spray one. They're both the same medication.
Yeah,
it's like anodon and paracetamol. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So what's just the difference part on the nasal one and
the injection? You have to go into the muscle with the nasal spray. You don't have needle.
Does it work just as
neat? Yeah.
Mm.
The injection.
I suppose sometimes, like when I'm out, these people, if somebody went over in front of me and they're there. You know, if you give them the nasal one, it'll bring them around straight away. With the injection one, you have to give one dose at a time to bring somebody around. Mm. Because if you give the whole lot together, if they come around, they're looking at the world completely different, where they're going to be dying sick and you just messed up the whole day. You know? But I suppose, but the platform I have then for going and visiting these places 3 days, so I deal with the business community in town as well. So if they have people...
Drug litter.
And if somebody was using it in car parks or underground flats or whatever car parks, I go in and then work with them.
Our business owners, are they frustrated? Are they angry? Are they understanding?
A lot of them, I think, in the last couple of years have coming around. They're all asking me, like, they're all in favour. There should be some place for people to go and have a place like that, because it's more of a health issue. But what I do is come in and we work for a solution. And my solution, as I said to one manager one place one day, because, look, he used to speak to me and I said to him, give me 2 weeks work with these people. And after, when I got them assessed and everything was done, when they were on the methadone program and they were stable, he rang me up and he said, now I see what you're talking about. Because if I was asking these people to move on, I'm only going down and having somebody else having the same conversation. So I asked for a bit of time. And then he says, I see. And I've been at a meeting recently where girls have zero tolerance. And I know there's issues around the businesses. But I met the manager at the same meeting. I said, you know the way I work, like. Moving them on is great, but that's not the solution. If I can connect somebody into a service and they're stable, that's the solution.
Because you're only displacing them. So the next business.
That's all.
Can you talk to me just before we finish up? Do you know, oftentimes we'd hear people on Neil Prendeville and PJ Coogan, the local radio stations, they're talking about the heroin issue in Cork is getting worse and worse and worse. But like, is it getting worse or is homelessness getting worse and it's a more visible form of drug use? Or what do you think?
I suppose, look, I'm going to be honest with you. A lot of people ask me that question. And for me personally, I never get involved.
Yeah.
The reason why, when I get into this, things getting better or worse, I lose my focus on the client. My focus is on the individual that comes to me and says, I want help. And if I get into saying things are better, when I go out and I'm in the bushes or I'm in place where nobody else will probably go, when somebody reaches out and says, I want help, or when they check me out, they ring me up like, so when I get into this thing, getting better or worse, I suppose for me, all I see is opiate use all the time because it seems to be my area. Like,
is there a big demand for your service?
Yeah, I've had two colleagues in the line. I had a colleague with me for a year and a half. I had a guy before that. But look, there's a job being advertised and closing date to date. So I'm hoping to have a new colleague. But look, you know, you're trying to do assessments. You're trying to get people in. You're trying to deal with the business. You're trying to deal with drug later. You know, and I cover Tralee as well.
Do you know if there's people listening to this here now and they wanted to know how to just to understand drug users on the streets and stuff like that, what would be a few words you would say to them maybe for them to just try to understand why people are where they are on the streets?
I think people are quick to judge. Like, you know, there's a lot of stigma attached to people, especially around heroin, right? You know, and they're junkies, they're all this and that. I know a lot of these people and I've got to know them over the years. None of them want to be there. They've just made the decision, like people experiment with drugs and unfortunately happen to be heroin. And when you know the process of heroin, people try heroin, we'll say, for a Friday night. They'll do it next week, Friday night. After a while, it grows Saturday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I had a guy saying to me, like, you know, I came to a realization that I was in trouble, so I stopped. The next thing, he was experiencing the withdrawals. And then he has to use to kill that. And I think if they understand, once people get addicted, once they transition to from experimenting to dependency, it's not like getting a bottle of wine and leaving the fridge and having a week's time. Like when they're experiencing withdrawals, it's like a flu-like symptoms coming on rapidly. They're sweating profusely. They have cramps in their stomach.
Cold.
They're going to have pains all over the body and they're going to have diarrhea.
And what does heroin do on the other side of it then?
When they take that, then it takes that sickness away. There's no more fun. There's no more high. They have to use to keep the sickness at bay. And like over my previous 9 years, nearly 9 years, all of those that engage, like, you know, just want to get their lives back on track.
Yeah.
And like, it's a very hard game to get out of. And especially, like, I suppose when you're talking about, you know, like, I didn't understand nothing about trauma, and I think I've had a tin lock here. So I didn't know what I was running for all my life, you know? And I think when you put down the drugs and you get a bit of space, and I found a lovely therapist at the time, and I've done a lot of work, you know? I remember going to her for some personal development done, and I had 140 sessions done with her. But I had to look at all that stuff of what was making me run towards this stuff as well, you know? Yeah. Why was I using? I was trying to escape all the hurt and the stuff in my life. But these people, a lot of them don't want to be there. And people say, it's their own fault. It's not. Do you know what I mean? They made decisions. I'm looking for somebody who has never made a decision. I haven't found one yet. These people just made, like I've made bad decisions, but now I've made good decisions. And look, sometimes I meet people that I wouldn't have seen for 10 or 15 years and I get to look like, you know?
I think you're a prime example of what we tried to make clear to everybody that listens and anybody that will listen. You're a prime example of change and how once you get to know the person and the context of their background, and how they are now. Because as I'm listening to you after the conversation about the early days, back in the addiction days and stuff, and now the person that's sitting in front of me, like if you separated the two conversations, and I would have never thought that you were ever involved in criminality or drugs, but to transfer from one thing to the other, it like that's why we do this podcast is to open up people's minds and get them to just think and maybe look at someone's background and where they came from, you know, the environment they grew up in, the school and all this stuff and the mental health and the addiction, and then to see, right, look at the change. And that's when people's perception of another human being changes, is when they get to know them from their background and who they are now. You know, and that's what we're trying to do, change that stigma around people who are on the streets, people inside in prisons, you know. And as we always say, we're not trying to say all these people are good and justify all their actions. It's just, listen, give them
a chance.
Just to think about
it. I think the perception that people have and, you know, the labelling of scumbags or drug addicts or whatever, everybody makes mistakes. And I would suggest, don't judge somebody for what they do or what mistakes they make. Like, try to understand where they're coming from. We all make mistakes. And when I have students out with me as well, you know, just to make things clear, when I have students out with me, we come up from a situation and somebody's sleeping in the bushes and that's where they're home, I'd always say, you know, that's sad. And they'd say, yeah, I said, remember, it could be them coming out visiting us next week.
Yeah.
You know?
Frank, if enough people wanted to say hi to you or reach out to you or give a bit of feedback, can they do that? Are you online anywhere or...?
I'm not. I mean, look, I have my work phone. That's it. I don't do social media because I train to trick. When I go home from work, I try not to come into town because, look, you know, I see a lot. It's not for me personally, when I see all this, I have to use...
A question, Frank.
Definitely.
Do you get supervision for what you do on the streets? Because
I have,
that must be a really, really difficult job. Like
it is.
You come across really dangerous situations and situations where somebody's probably dead or dying in front of you because you're going to places where nobody else would go to.
Exactly.
So you have supervision.
I have supervision. I have internal and external supervision. And like I have colleagues as well. I can sit down and go for a coffee because, you know, some people say to me, like, you can go home and they can leave this outside the office door. I can go home sometimes and it takes a while to wash off because the sadness. But you're talking about other human beings. That's what you're talking about here. And people who just made the same mistakes that I made. I was blessed because I think taking the time in prison to recover and stay clean, it gave me time and the ability to go back and get more help outside of Arbor House to look at why was I going this way when I need to be going that way. I was running all the time. I didn't know who I was, you know what I mean? And I think having that outside help and having to be able to trust somebody that you can tell this stuff to.
You know, it's my belief, God or whoever or the universe or whatever people want to call it, they give people like us these really difficult backgrounds so we can go on and do roles that we continue to do today in our lives, like what you're doing on the streets with the lads, you know, what we're doing here with the podcast.
Yeah,
and others who just like us, there's millions, there's fucking loads, but we'll all individually do what we're doing because of our lived experiences in addiction and prison and whatever. And that's it, that's your purpose. If you can just understand that.
But I think sometimes the one kind of, I suppose, weakness I still see I have, I never say well done. My focus is always, because for me it's like once I have somebody into a stabilization program, you've the next person and you focus and you're always kept going. There's always somebody pulling you. There's always somebody in crisis and you do your best for them. And they know if you're serious, if you're there. And if you're there, they'll know. If they'll come with you if you can just understand. And sometimes you have to come down and meet them where they're at and be at their level. Yeah. Me going in as this guy, I'm the counsellor, I know best, I know nothing. I just want to connect with you. And if you want to come with me, I promise you, I'll put 100% behind you and I will knock at doors for you.
Well, you're doing God's work in Cork City.
Thank
and
you.
No better Buchel for the job either.
Thank
I
you.
Hope you get a good partner with your latest recruitment drive.
I'm hoping so.
And it's an important role.
Yeah.
And this has been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very
much for your time today.
Thanks. I really appreciate it.
See everybody next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.